You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. And you are Shireen Aladimi, which I think I've correctly pronounced.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And you, some congratulations are in order. You just earned a PhD, didn't you?
I earned an EDD, yes, my doctorate in education.
This very week at Harvard, is that right?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you know what you're going to do next?
Yeah, I'm actually heading to Michigan State University for an assistant professorship.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you're gainfully employed. Not everyone with a graduate degree can say that, believe me. So now another thing about you is that you are from Yemen. You were born there. You grew up there, or at least until I guess the age of 12, you were in Yemen. And unbeknownst to many Americans, America is in some sense involved in a war in Yemen and has been for a few years. And so I wanted to talk about that from your perspective. You've become a little bit of an activist. I mean, I don't know how much time you spend actually like marching in the streets, but you've got a, you know, a somewhat active Twitter feed. You're paying a lot of attention to the issue, understandably. You have a lot of family in Yemen still, right?
I do.
So I would just like to, you know, explore the whole issue from your perspective and try to help people understand a little more clearly how we got involved in this, what the stakes are, and what kind of toll it's taking. For starters, what kind of toll is it taking? How would you describe what's going on in Yemen right now?
Well, I'll tell you what the UN says. The UN says that this is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. So I'll start with that. And what that actually means is that 80% of the population in Yemen, around 25 million people, are in need of humanitarian aid every single day. 13 million are dependent on emergency services. So, you know, there's a complete collapse of the economic sector, the health sector, or the education sector. People are really just desperate to find food, to find clean water. It's really as bad as it can get anywhere in the world.
Okay. Now, it's a civil war between the, as commonly described, between the Houthis in the north and technically the officially recognized government in the south. Is that right?
Well, the officially recognized government is not in Yemen. It's based out of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, so they're not even don't even have an office. So it's a government in exile.
Yeah. And a civil war is how it began, but it can no longer accurately be described as a civil war, given how many foreign countries are involved in the war.
Uh-huh. And Saudi Arabia is doing a lot of bombing, of the Houthi-held area, right?
So the Houthi-held area is where 80% of the population lives. So when the Saudis bomb, they're bombing most Yemenis.
Okay, and the there's various. First, let's elaborate a little on the toll. So, how many people have been killed? The civil war started in 2015, about 3 years ago.
Right.
And how many people have been killed? First of all, in directly, like through violence.
Through violence, the figures say 10,000 civilians, but that figure was last updated by the UN in January of 2017. And we know that the bombings are ongoing every single day. The local toll is more like, you know, 15,000 people, civilians that have been killed by just, you know, airstrikes mostly.
Mm-hmm. And then there is also, there's other sources of mortality. I mean, well, first of all, wars are often disruptive and lead to, you know, like hospitals go out of commission and so on. But in addition to that, there is a blockade. Is that strictly a weapons blockade or what?
Well, it's a blockade for whatever Saudi Arabia decides it is. In November, they decided that they were also going to prevent all food from coming into the country for a couple of weeks, and lots of people died then. But they're saying that they're trying to prevent weapons entry into Yemen, but They've also prevented aid shipments. So organizations like UNICEF and Save the Children, Oxfam have had difficulties bringing in medicine and personnel and food and, you know, clean water into the country. So, you know, it's a blockade. It prevents the entry of fuel, food, medicine, water, you name it.
And what is the U.S. doing in support of the Saudi war effort?
So the U.S. has been involved right from the first day of the U.S. bombing in Yemen.
During the Obama administration.
During the Obama administration. And it's just seamlessly continued through the Trump administration without, you know, any really discussion about U.S.'s role in Yemen until recently in Congress. But the U.S. provides extensive support. So, of course, you know, and I'm sure your audience knows about the weapons shipments, the weapons deals between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, and those number in the hundreds of billions of dollars. But in addition to that, the U.S. refuels Saudi jets midair. So as they're bombing civilian targets or whatever else the Saudis are saying they're bombing, the U.S. Army helps refuel their planes midair. They also train soldiers. They provide logistical support. We've recently learned about the existence of U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets, at the Saudi Arabian border. So they're actively fighting the Houthis at the Saudi Arabian border. Mm-hmm. So this is as extensive as it can get, the U.S. support to the Saudi Arabians.
Okay. And just to step back and locate your origins in this context, you were born in the South, is that right? I mean... There, Yemen was once two countries, right? Because there was North Yemen and South Yemen until I think 1990, because the British had occupied South Yemen while Northern Yemen, I guess, what remained in the hands of the Ottoman Empire or something.
Right.
And so there was that kind of division, and did that line that didn't neatly correspond to any ethnic division, did it?
No, there are no ethnic divisions, but certainly regional divisions. And many Yemenis, unfortunately, still think of North and South, despite, you know, almost now 30 years of unity between North and South. But yeah, I was born in Aden, which was the capital of the South. And the capital of Yemen right now is Sana'a.
And is where you were born, is that now in Houthi hands? Or
no, it's under the coalition hands. And increasingly, people are feeling like it's occupation. So initially, many Southerners had supported the Saudi-led coalition. They supported the Emiratis, the Saudis coming in and fighting off the Houthis on behalf of the recognized government in Yemen. But increasingly, they're feeling like they don't have any say in what happens in Yemen. And ministers have to seek permission to enter Yemen from the Saudi-led coalition. So it's more like occupation than in the hands of the Yemeni government.
By both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates?
Is that right. United Arab Emirates.
Emirates.
Yeah.
So the part that you were associated, the part that you remember is nominally being supported by Saudi Arabia, but what you're saying is that the people are increasingly not enthusiastic about the Saudi support, even
right
there.
So the United Arab Emirates are operating secret weapons in the South. Anybody that they suspect of being associated with Al-Qaeda or Muslim Brotherhood or anything that the UAE decides to label as a terrorist, anybody that they label as a terrorist, they basically kidnap them. And these people are, you know, found or, you know, we're told that they're in secret prisons where the UAE is involved in extensive torture. So that's not what the Southerners welcomed when they thought that they were welcoming Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And increasingly also the UAE seems to have ambitions in South Yemen. There's an island called Socotra off the coast in the south, and they seem to have some plans for occupying that island as well. So, you know, nobody's in it for the people. Every country obviously is in it for its own strategic interests, and that's what's evident in Yemen.
Yeah, and one of the strategic interests commonly cited is that the Houthis are said to be allied with Iran. There's argument over the extent to which that's actually the case, but is that the most commonly cited reason by Saudi Arabia for the Well, I guess they also, I mean, people who intervene always say they're doing it on behalf of the people, so I'm sure they say that. But as far as their strategic, as far as why they're interested in it, is that the thing they most often say?
So that's what they say. They say that Iran is involved in Yemen, that Iran is, you know, that the Houthis are Iranian puppets, that Iran is intending to control Yemen through the Houthis. And that can be nothing, you know, can be further from the truth. It's, of course, not challenged very often, but the evidence for any Iranian, any extensive Iranian support in Yemen is scant. Here we are more than 3 years into the war. You don't find any Iranian generals in Yemen. There aren't any credible accounts of any Iranian weapon shipments in Yemen. Like I mentioned, like you mentioned earlier, there's a blockade, which the U.S. Navy is also helping enforce. And so the country is blockaded land, air, and sea by the Saudi Arabians and the United States. But we're somehow led to believe that the Iranians are sneaking in missiles to Yemen. So that's what the Saudi Arabians are saying. That's, of course, not why they're there.
Now, I guess the evidence cited is generally that weapons of Iranian origin have been found in the hands of the Houthis or have been used by the Houthis?
That's what they're saying. But, you know, for example, Nikki Haley had famously held up a missile saying that this had Iranian parts. Well, that missile had more American parts than Iranian parts. Ali Abdel Saleh, the previous president of Yemen, had for years and years and years stockpiled missiles and weapons. And so that's what they're using. And it's not very much. I mean, they don't even have an air defense system against Saudi missiles. And so you think that if Iran was providing anything, they'd provide that as well. But there's been no evidence of that.
Well, certainly, I mean, Syria shows us what it looks like when Iran decides to get involved in a thoroughgoing way. It's definitely not that. I mean, you know it when it gets to that extent.
Exactly.
This issue on, like, so if I remember her photo op with, I mean, didn't she actually drag out this, like, missile, Nikki Haley, this, like,
yeah.
So if it was established that there were American parts as well as Iranian parts, does that get reported anywhere, or?
I mean, okay, so 2 days after her photo op with the missile, there was a UN secret report that was published by The Intercept that said that there was no evidence that that missile came from Iran, that it was from within Yemen. And that doesn't get reported. And so, you know, there's all this buzz about Iranian influence in Yemen, but the evidence is just not there to support it.
So, I mean, I know it isn't your job to opine on the actual motivations of American politicians, but I'm genuinely puzzled, like, when you see how enthusiastic people like, well, Secretary of State Pompeo and presumably Bolton and the whole crew is for supporting Saudi Arabia. Do you think they are I mean, we know they are deeply anti-Iranian. That is clear. Do you think they are genuinely under the impression that this is like an Iranian proxy war, or?
Absolutely not. I think the motivation simply, honestly, is money. The Saudi Arabians have interest in Yemen. So Yemen is at the southern border, and Yemen controls Bab al-Mandab, which is the Strait of Bab al-Mandab, where 4 million barrels of oil travel every single day, largely, you know, Saudi Arabian oil. Of course, the U.S. also wants to maintain some strategic influence in that area. But looking historically at the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, Saudi Arabia has always had an influence in Yemen politically. So we always had somebody in power in Yemen who was willing to do Saudi Arabia's bidding. Ali Abdel Saleh was very famous for that. And part of the Houthis' rise to power was their anti-interventionist stand, so anti-foreign interventionist stand. And so for the first time, Saudi Arabia felt like they would have somebody in power, if the Houthis were to gain that much power, who just would not serve their interests in Yemen. So that's why they attacked. And the reason the U.S. is helping them is because the Saudis are paying for it. So we have hundreds of billions in weapon sales. We have 123 contracts. I forget the actual figures, but the U.S. Army was boasting about how many contracts they had in the kingdom, training soldiers, repairing their vehicles, updating their aircrafts, and so on. So, you know, they're getting paid very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to pursue this line. But first, I'm realizing I think I forgot to ask you whether there is, when we talk about the number of Yemenis who have died as a result of the war, but not as a result of violence, do we have any kind of estimate on that?
We have an estimate of how many children were killed. These are estimates from the UN and from Save the Children. And the numbers honestly are horrific. In 2016 and 2017, so this doesn't include 2018 or 2015, but in those 2 years, 113,000 children either starved to death or died because of diseases like cholera.
Oh my
the
God.
Cure for cholera is clean water. And, you know, hydrating with electrolytes and clean water. Yet 113,000 children, you know, died of starvation.
So the water system is disrupted by the bombing?
Well, again, corruption and poor management of water supplies in Yemen meant that Yemen was importing a lot of its water from Saudi Arabia, ironically. Yemen imported 90% of its food and water from outside sources before the war. And so when they're blockading the country and they're deciding what comes in and what comes out, there's no clean water in the country. They've bombed facilities that purify water. And so, you know, people are having to drink contaminated water. They get diseases like cholera and diphtheria, which had been eradicated in Yemen for decades. And then they're not able to survive because they're weakened by hunger and they don't have clean water for treatment. And so, you know, the number 113,000 children, that's what we know. And the UN also estimates that, you know, every 10 minutes, a child dies of starvation or preventable diseases.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so back to the Saudi connection. So first of all, do you think that maybe, first of all, Saudi Arabia, or at least some people in Saudi Arabia, I mean, they are pretty, I don't want to say Iranophobic, but they have a thing about Iran. And look, it's a contest for regional influence between powers. I'm not saying it's like all in their head, but do you think that they themselves may exaggerate the extent of association between the Houthi rebels and Iran?
I mean, it's a selling point for them. How else do they tell their population that they're bombing the Middle East's poorest country, a country that doesn't even have a proper air defense system? A country that poses no threat to themselves. How else do they sell that story? And so they have to say that it's because of Iran. You know, they have to make it look like it's an equal, like a war between equal powers. And that's what gets reported in the news as well. And the reality is that that's just not the case. Yes, the Houthis have a good relationship with Iran, but short of, you know, outside of, you know, positive attention in the media on, you know, for the Houthis, there's not much tangible influence there. But the Saudis are certainly exaggerating that. And the U.S. has been just repeating that same Saudi narrative.
I mean, I guess one reason it's an appealing narrative is because, both, Iran and the Houthis are Shia, although of a somewhat different kind, right? I mean, there are 12ers and there are 5ers. We don't need to get into all that, but
not the same kind of Shia.
What's that?
They're not the same kind of Shia.
Right. I mean, not that theological doctrine is necessarily determinative anyway, but it's just not all that natural a cultural association. I mean, for one thing, they don't speak Persian. They're Arabs, right? I mean, the Houthis.
And just to add to that, you know, when President Saleh was an ally, a staunch ally of Saudi Arabia, nobody was calling him out for being a Zaydi. Nobody was drawing that association when he was fighting the Houthis himself for several years. Nobody was saying that he's a Zaydi and he's fighting Zaydis. It wasn't a Sunni Shia issue back then. It became a Sunni Shia issue when Saudi Arabia decided to attack.
So we should say that by Zaydi, now Zaydi, and that refers to these Shia, but is Zaydi, what exactly does Zaydi mean? Does that mean the Fiver Shia in Yemen? That's just an ethnic designation, kind of?
Yeah, so they follow, their leader, his name was Zayd, and so,
okay.
Yeah, that's what they're called. But in theology, they're closer to Sunni Islam than they are to Shia Islam.
So when the president, Saleh, was, he is himself a Zaydi?
Yes.
And he was fighting the Houthis. So much for this kind of like ethnic or religious determinism kind of view of what people fight over.
Exactly.
And he's been back and forth. I mean, I think later in the conversation we'll get into the history a little bit, but it is kind of complicated. So on this business of American motivation, now do you think, aside from the money, there is just this kind of, I mean, Saudi Arabia is your ally. They ask for something because it started in the Obama administration, and I don't imagine Obama was quite as directly motivated by just dollar signs. I mean, Donald Trump, when the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia visited recently, Mohammed bin Salman, right. Trump kind of embarrassed him, I gather, by like holding up these charts. The guy was like meeting with Trump in the White House. There was a photo op. Trump pulls out these charts that looked like they were made for a fifth grade art class, first of all.
Exactly.
But they were like showing these weapon systems and the amount of money that Saudi Arabia is paying for them. It's like, this is why this guy's here, to give us money. That's not a very gracious way to treat a guest, but it was that crass, right?
But it was the truth. So he was transparent about why Mohammed bin Salman was in the U.S. and what the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. has been for a number of years. Of course, the Obama administration wouldn't wrap it up that way. The Obama administration might say things like, oh, we're trying to curtail Iranian influence in Yemen. And, you know, of course, they have strategic interests in the area, protecting that, you know, having influence over Bab al-Mandeb, which Yemen controls. But at the end of the day, I still think that largely it's because Lockheed Martin and Textron and all these companies have just made so much money from the Saudis, and they continue to pay. So we continue to provide those services.
And some of them, I mean, these defense contractors, some of them also support Washington think tanks pretty big time. I mean, I haven't looked into this in a long time, but I think the Center for New American Security, which styles itself as a kind of a liberal-ish think tank, and in fact provided some officials, sent some officials into the Obama administration, I'm pretty sure it has gotten defense contractor money. And, you know, if you look who writes the op-eds, they come from these think tanks.
Yeah, exactly. And just to go back, I did find that reference for you. There's 123 contracts with the Saudis currently, totaling $120 million per month. So that's in addition to the billions sold in weapons. So it very much is a relationship, I think, based on money.
Yeah. We should say, by the way, there was recently an item about how this very think tank, the Center for New American Security, got money from, I think, UAE. It was a Persian Gulf state that paid, like, for one report, they paid $250,000.
Wow.
I just want to say, I can do it for cheaper. I will give them a report for $150,000, and it too will say whatever they want it to say. But I forget whether that was UAE, but it was CNAS. It was that think tank. Okay, so, and maybe we should talk a little about this prince, because he really, I don't know when, so he was elevated through some intra-family, like, maneuverings in the Saudi Arabia and became, he is now the heir apparent.
Right.
And he's kind of running the show.
Yes.
And he greatly, after his elevation to this position of influence or some position of influence, he greatly accelerated the war, right?
So he began this war, actually. His father took power in January of 2015 and made him defense secretary. And at the time he was deputy crown prince. Now he's crown prince. But, you know, so January, his father and he, you know, he and his father take control. And in March, he starts bombing Yemen. And what he was saying at the time, I mean, he called the operation, Operation Decisive Storm. So implying that this was going to be just a 2 weeks mission. They're going to, you know, just disable the Houthis in Yemen and somehow, you know, go back to, quote unquote, restoring hope. And of course, we know that that hasn't panned out for him. I think he was trying to prove himself. He had come into the international spotlight. Nobody knew how old he was. Nobody knew where he had come from. And as defense minister, this was his project. Yemen was his project.
Okay. And he's been pretty warmly received. I mean, Tom Friedman wrote, I think it's fair to call this a kind of a puff piece about him. You remember the column, no doubt, right? Now, I guess he did mention Yemen in, like, one paragraph or something, but it was – or did he not even mention Yemen? Do you remember?
I don't remember him. Maybe he had mentioned it just in passing, but what I remember is from Friedman and from many other journalists in the U.S. when he was making the rounds here is Yemen is mentioned. He's allowed to say whatever he wants. So he blamed, for example, the humanitarian crisis on the Houthis, even though he's the one blocking the entire country. And – you know, that's it. There's no follow-up questions. There's no challenging of the narrative that Saudi Arabia has been mentioning.
Okay. And maybe we should now back up a little into the background. I know it's complicated, but by way of figuring out, like, where, like, if Saudi Arabia would cease and desist, if the outside intervention stopped, like, what we might expect or hope would happen, it might be useful to understand the background a little, right? So, now, first of all, the U.S. was involved in Yemen before the civil war. We were bombing, we were doing drone strikes against Al-Qaeda targets.
We still are.
So they are in kind of a third area by and large. I mean, there's Houthi controlled and there's Saudi backed, and then there's a more of like a hinterland where Al-Qaeda is, or what?
No, the Saudi controlled territories, they also share that with Al-Qaeda. And so the interesting thing about Al-Qaeda and their association with the Saudi led intervention is at times during the past couple of years, the Saudis have been very open in their collaboration with Al-Qaeda members. And so here's the great irony. The U.S. is saying that we're trying to rid Yemen of Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, and ISIS and whatnot. But here are their allies working openly with Saudi Arabia when it suits them best. So this was documented by Frontline, by the BBC. The Hadi government that we support, that the U.S. supports, has appointed people on the list of U.S. terrorists as governors, for example. And so there's a close relationship there between Saudi Arabia, the Yemeni government that they're supporting, and Al-Qaeda. And it's just a matter of a power grab now. You know, sometimes they have certain areas that they control. Other times Al-Qaeda or ISIS come in and they wrangle control from the Saudis. So, you know, for the rest of Yemenis watching this happen, it's like this complete, it's like living in the Twilight Zone. What's happening? The U.S. is supposed to be getting rid of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and here they are working with people who are openly working with Al-Qaeda.
So, on the one hand, we support the Saudis, and they do business with Al-Qaeda, I guess partly because Al-Qaeda has real influence there, and so the Saudis do business with them. But every once in a while, we kill some Al-Qaeda with drone strikes, and the Saudis just kind of live with that, or what?
Yeah, the Saudis don't attack Al-Qaeda. The U.S. comes and they have drone strikes or other operations where they target Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Now, in my opinion, I don't think anybody should be involved in Yemen or anywhere else. I'm not an interventionist. I don't have an interventionist mentality. But technically, what the U.S. is doing with Al-Qaeda is approved by Congress. But what they're doing, helping the Saudi Arabians in their war against the Houthis, that is not approved by Congress. And in fact, Congress has said, we have not authorized this. The U.S. should not be involved in Yemen.
When did Congress say that?
So when they failed to pass HCON Resolution 81 back in October, they did pass an alternate measure that was not binding. I think it was HCON 599 or something like that. But that's when they acknowledged that the U.S. is in Yemen helping Saudi Arabia, even though it's unauthorized by Congress.
So it's a House resolution, like a non-binding House resolution?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then there's also an ISIS presence somewhere in Yemen, is that right?
Which is relatively new. And again, so many groups were working with Saudi Arabia and the UAE to try to get rid of the Houthis. And then when the coalition took control of the South, all of these groups started to try to gain their own independent power. So, mm-hmm. Yes, that's a relatively new phenomenon.
Okay. And, I mean, I assume that to some extent the chaos the war brings works in their favor, right?
Right.
So we were involved even, because there was some Al-Qaeda in Yemen, we were involved even before the civil war. And then what is it possible to, in very simple form, sketch the sequence of events that led to the civil war? I mean, there had been unhappiness among the Houthis with the way they were being governed, even when the country was unified, right?
Yes. And so the Houthis began, Houthi, by the way, comes from the last name of one family. And in the 90s, Hussein al-Houthi began preaching in mosques against the corruption in the Yemeni government. It's no secret that Ali Abdel Saleh was one of the richest men in the world, and Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. And they began preaching.
And he was the president, is that?
And he was the president, right, of Yemen at the time. And he had been president from 78 till, you know, and then the Unified Yemen as well, president of Unified Yemen until 2011. They were protesting corruption in the government. They were protesting, I think many Yemenis were protesting this, but the Houthis became the most prominent voice, I think, at the time, protesting foreign intervention of the U.S., of Saudi Arabia and whatnot. And once Ali Abdullah Saleh saw them as a threat, he tried to enlist the Saudis and the U.S. At some point, which wasn't successful, but he tried to enlist the help of the Saudi Arabians to get rid of the Houthis, and that was unsuccessful. So there were a series of wars over a decade between him and the Houthis, and he wasn't able to get rid of them. And then in January 2011, when the Arab Spring erupted, Yemen also found itself in that mood, in that climate, and they began peacefully protesting. And not just ordinary Yemenis, but Yemenis of various political factions, including the Houthis. The Houthis had joined the peaceful protests as well. Mm-hmm. And the turning point, I think, was in May of 2011 when a group that was closely associated with Saleh, which are the Islah Party of Yemen, they're the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen. They had been co-ruling, you know, Yemen with Saleh for decades, and then all of a sudden they turned against him mm-hmm. and joined the opposition, kind of like hijacked the People's Revolution.
Can we pause there just because Muslim Brotherhood has become such a phrase in America? I mean, in fact, most recently, thanks to Roseanne Barr, but you know, it's become, it's like, you know, it's kind of like a scare term. Whereas my understanding is that the term has referred to a number of different groups in a number of different countries that do profess some commonality of ideology and purpose. But I mean, I think that the idea in America is that, you know, if you're Muslim Brotherhood, it means you want to infiltrate the United States and blow up buildings or something. I mean, what does it actually mean? What did it actually mean in Yemen? What did that group want, and how did they, you know, do business and so on?
I mean, they were a political party like any other party in Yemen, and, you know, had wide influence, and they had, you know, they shared many seats in parliament alongside Saleh's party. So Saleh had the GPC party, and then they, you know, they were the second most prominent party in Yemen. Now, the thing is with, in Yemen specifically, and this is may not apply to Muslim Brotherhoods in other areas, but they're an Islamist party, and they did have, you know, they're an extremist. They did have extremists within that party mm-hmm. who did have affiliations with Al-Qaeda.
And I think maybe we should pause one more time, because I think some people think Islamist means you want to blow up buildings. I mean, Islamist means you want your government to be explicitly guided by religious doctrine, right? I mean,
right. It's like a, you know, a theocracy or
right.
a state that has some kind of semblance of a theocracy.
Right.
But of course that can apply to Iran as well, which is a theocracy, but they're a Shia government. So
right.
they have nothing to do with Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood is a Sunni
right.
Political organization.
Okay.
But it's not centralized anywhere. So Muslim Brotherhood in Yemen looks very different from Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example.
Okay. So, as you were saying, there were extremists who were Muslim Brotherhood in Yemen, but that did not apply to all of them by any means.
Right, right. And they shared power with Ali Abdullah Saleh, and for many years they were, you know, the two most dominant parties were the Saleh's party and the Muslim Brotherhood party. And so for them to join the opposition was very disingenuous. I mean, it was a grab for power. They saw an opportunity to turn against Saleh. Whereas people, I think, what they were protesting was the system, which they were very much part of. And not just, you know, it just became then about protesting one person, Saleh, and not the entire system that he had created.
So the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood joined with the Shia Houthis at that point?
So everybody joined,
yeah.
and, you know, the protesters, and it became, you know, protest against Saleh. But that's when it turned violent, because prior to that, it was not violent. No other group had used violence. But then the Islah Party decided that they were going to try to assassinate Saleh, and they almost succeeded. So And it wasn't until he was treated, he had severe burns, he was flown to Saudi Arabia. He had refused to resign up until that point. And then finally, when he did come back from Saudi Arabia, when he was after undergoing treatment in November of that year, that's when he resigned and handed power to his vice president at the time, who's Hadi.
Okay. But it wasn't until 2015 that the civil war per se, as we understand it now.
Right, because from November 2011 till March 2015, Hadi was appointed in a one-man election for 2 years, and then it was extended for another year, and still he had not done any of the things that he promised to do. And the Houthis started marching toward the capital in order to try to exert influence on him, and that's when he resigned, fled to Aden, and then took back his resignation, and then Saudi Arabia began bombing.
Okay, and so who is the, he is nominally the leader of this relatively small part of Yemen that the Saudis are supporting. There's no clear, like, leader on the ground there?
He's not even the leader of that small part of Yemen that the Saudis are supporting, because if there's one thing that unites Yemenis, it's that nobody wants Hadi. And so the Southerners themselves formed another political council, and they are actively seeking separation from the north, and they're the governing body in the south currently. So Hadi, again, has these ministers appointed. They have no control, no influence in Yemen. He himself sits in Saudi Arabian hotels and issues, orders or whatever he does on Facebook.
But there's nobody to follow the orders, or...?
I mean, he appoints people, but they work with the Saudis, and Saudis kind of dictate. Saudi Arabia and the UAE dictate what they want to dictate. So the interesting thing here, again, is the split between Saudi Arabian interests and UAE interests. So the UAE is supporting the separatist movement in the south that created its own governing body, and the Saudis are still, nominally supporting Hadi. And sometimes there are clashes between people that the UAE is supporting and people that the Saudis are supporting in South Yemen, where supposedly, the coalition has control.
Huh. So I guess the Saudi, their main form of intervention is bombing. I guess it's not as if they need to closely coordinate with whatever the actual governing body is in the South, right? I mean, they're mainly just bombing.
The Saudis don't even have any Saudi troops in Yemen.
Right.
They have, South American troops. They have Blackwater people. They have, Sudanese and Senegalese troops, but they're not themselves on the ground.
So I didn't even realize there was that degree of tension between UAE and Saudi interests.
Right.
The UAE, does UAE support the Saudi bombing campaign?
Oh, yeah, they're bombing together.
They are bombing together. But how many people in the South are really enthusiastic about that?
Not anymore, right? And
right.
So I think a lot of people in the South saw this as an opportunity to gain secession from the North, which in my mind is ironic because they're accepting foreign occupation to repel northern Yemeni occupation. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make any sense to me. But the idea was that we don't want to live under North Yemen anymore. We want to have our own country. Of course, Saudi Arabia has no interest in dividing Yemen. If they did, then they would have left in 2015, in July of 2015, when they gained control over the former South.
Mm-hmm. So if you look at what the traditional border was between North Yemen and South Yemen was back when they were two countries, and the border that I guess defines a certain kind of national identity in the minds of some of these people still – the Houthis have exceeded that border. So some of the South is under, in the minds of Southerners, the control of Northerners. Is that fair to say?
I think the Houthis are pretty much confined to
the North?
Yeah, historic Northern Yemen.
Okay. So what do you think would happen if outside intervention ceased? I mean, it sounds like it's a two-part question, because there is the bombing, the military intervention. But even if you took that out of the picture, you've got some UAE influence on the ground in the South. But if you just so I don't know how you want to address the question. I guess it's a complicated scenario.
I mean, it's still the best case scenario is that for all of this foreign intervention to stop, we have the U.S. helping and the U.K. and France helping extensively you know, Saudi Arabia and the UAE and a coalition of other countries. Qatar was also part of it until their spat with Saudi Arabia last summer. If you have all of these people stop their bombing campaign, lift the blockade, then of course there's still factions within Yemen that have to work their issues out. But that's for Yemenis to decide. Then that is truly a civil war or a civil conversation or, you know, a national conversation or whatever it looks like. Yemenis aren't even given the chance to think about what could happen. Because right now they're just trying to defend themselves or survive, you know, this foreign occupation and the bombing campaign and the blockade and so on.
Do you think there is a lot of support on both the north, in the, both the north and the south, for just separation, returning to either actual the creation of actually two nations or some extreme degree of you know, like
Federation.
Autonomy?
That was on the table before this intervention. That was one of the things that the Hadi government at the time had explored, and people seemed to be considering that option. The northern Yemenis, by and large, still don't want to secede from the south. The southerners, many of them, want to secede from the north because of the 1994 war, where the north basically, the south, and this is a war I lived through, the south had announced secession and the north attacked. And so they're seeing as the occupiers. But I think people would be willing definitely to talk about, at the very least, some autonomous state, you know, I don't know, Quebec within Canada or something like that.
And so are you, how active are you? I mean, I know you, you try to bring this to raise awareness of this. This is basically an online thing for you or what?
I also do talks. So it started off online. Honestly, it started the day the war started, March 26, 2015. I just didn't know, you know, I knew from family back home that there was a war happening and I didn't know what was going on because none of the news outlets were reporting it. And so I just joined Twitter to learn more about what was happening. And then I thought, well, here we are in America and people don't know the extent of U.S. Involvement in Yemen. So my focus has been to raise awareness to the American public, because I don't think that people would hear about this, would learn about it, and still accept what the government is doing to help Saudi Arabians really just destroy a country that poses no threat to us. And so I give talks. I write. I try to get people to call their senators and their congressmen. And, you know, in addition to sharing information online.
And you feel you and others like you are having success? Is awareness growing?
I mean, a little bit of success is, you know, a lot. And when there was calls for the Senate resolution a few months ago, tens of thousands of people called that number that people set up to try to get their senators to not intervene in Yemen. And so I think that's progress. And, you know, any kind of awareness on the issue is progress. Any kind of action that results is progress.
Okay. And what... Do you think the Saudis have a clear end game in mind? I mean, what do they like have some dream version of Yemen?
I think their dream version is that, you know, the Houthis would just surrender. And by the way, the Houthis were not the only ones who were fighting the Saudis. Saleh turned against or, you know, worked with the Houthis for a while.
Yeah, the former president. Yeah.
Right. It didn't end very well for him in the end. But
how did it? You mean the.
The Houthis killed him.
While he was supporting them?
Well, he, within a few days, kind of seemed to turn against them. And there was indication that he was trying to work with the UAE to try to resolve things and, you know, still come out the victor. And, you know, it was kind of too late because the Houthis at this point are very well entrenched in Sana'a, where he lives. And so there was a battle and he was killed within a couple of days. But, you know, most Yemenis, even if they don't agree with the Houthis or don't want the Houthis to govern them, they don't want foreign occupation. They see what's happening in South Yemen, where the legitimate government is supposedly, you know, in control and where Saudi's in control. And there are assassinations almost every single day. There are, you know,
why are there assassinations? I mean, who's assassinating whom?
Well, there are all these different groups now vying for power, whether they're right. Muslim Brotherhood or Al-Qaeda or ISIS or UAE-backed people or Saudi-backed people. And so, you know, you won't see terrorist attacks in Houthi-controlled areas where 80% of the population live. But, you know, there are terrorist attacks all the time in the south.
So the Houthi area is a place where their order would prevail if they would quit bombing it.
I think so, because most of the displaced people, internally displaced people, have nowhere to go, so they're displaced internally, and they go to Houthi-controlled areas, because at least they don't have to worry about, bombs going off on the ground by Al-Qaeda terrorists or whatnot.
And do you think the Houthis do aspire to control the whole country? I mean, would they take as much would their military campaign continue toward the south if they could get away with it?
I think it was a big mistake for the Houthis to go south, and they realized that because they haven't tried to move south, since then. But in 2014, they signed an agreement for a unity government. I don't think they were trying. I think part of the reason that they allied themselves with Saleh was because they wanted to leave the governing up to him and his party. These guys are fighters, and they wanted a role in the government, but they didn't want to. I don't think they want to control all of Yemen, and I don't think all of Yemen would support, Houthi control all over the country. So I think they would be willing to do some kind of power sharing deal, just as they have done in the past when they signed, the UN-backed mm-hmm. unity government proposal.
So how long has it been since the Houthis were trying to expand southward militarily?
So that ended in July 2015.
Okay, so it's not like Saudi Arabia can say they're trying to stop aggression.
No. The Houthis right now are trying to stave off the Saudis from attacking Hodeida, which is the port. And unfortunately, there are reports that they're marching toward, the Saudis and the UAE are advancing toward the port of Hodeida, which would be a complete disaster for Yemen because, it's the lifeline of Yemen. 70% of the food and water comes in from that port. And so if they destroy Hodeida, if they attack that port, then so many more millions of people will starve to death. And that's where the Houthis are trying to, stave off the Saudis right now.
But when you say they're advancing toward the port, they don't have troops on the ground, do they, the Saudis?
When I say the Saudis, I mean the Yemeni-backed Saudis. UAE-backed forces.
So they are making gains on the ground at the expense of the Houthis?
It seems so, in the past couple of weeks especially.
And again, can you spell out a little more your fear of why it would be disastrous if they took that port?
So this port, it's on the Red Sea. It's the port of Hodeida. I have many family members there. I spent all my summers in that city. It's the lifeline of Yemen. It's where most, 70% of aid and food and whatnot comes in through that port. Uh-huh. And even the Obama administration had, that was the one line they drew when it comes to supporting the Saudis. They didn't want an advance on Hodeida port because that would literally starve millions of people to death. If you remember this past November when the Saudis blockaded Yemen, what they did is that they essentially imposed a total blockade on Hodeida, and kids were dying left, right, and
center. So they encircled it from the sea at that point.
Yes, I mean they're still there. They're in control in the sea. They have say over what comes in and what comes in basically.
Did the Trump administration pressure them to let relax on the food front, or am I hallucinating?
Trump did mention something, but nothing. There wasn't a follow up. The Saudis lifted the blockade when they felt they would lift the blockade. And when I say lift the blockade, they're still blockading Yemen, but, they lifted the total blockade. Mm-hmm. And so that port is still open. It's still functioning. They bombed it 2 days ago. They bombed a part of it. And so they're, and they're advancing toward that port, trying to control it. So any kind of fighting in Hodeida or if the Saudis control Hodeida port fully and decide to blockade it again, fully, then, people starve to death. It's as simple as that.
Okay. Because they will, to the extent they control the port, they will use it to deprive food to the Houthi area, in your view.
As they have been, as they've shown, that they were willing to use starvation.
Yeah. Okay. So this is not encouraging. The final question is just going to be on the minds of, or at least semifinal, going to be on the minds of some Americans is, okay, so there's Al-Qaeda and ISIS there. Is America helping itself on that front by supporting the Saudis? I mean, first of all, in my experience, usually groups like this, they have their hands full locally, and it's like they're not necessarily aspiring to, like, send people to attack America if America leaves them alone. Not always the case, but sometimes. Is that the deal here?
Yeah, this has nothing to do with attacking America. You have Al-Qaeda and ISIS there, so the question is, why are we helping Saudi Arabia, who works with Al-Qaeda, when they see fit?
Yeah.
So that's really the big question. The Houthis have been the most successful group against Al-Qaeda. And that's not something I'm saying. That's something everybody's been saying. When they were left to fight the Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they were very successful at it. The Americans coming in and bombing and then, on the other hand, supporting Saudi Arabia, who works with the Al-Qaeda, makes no sense. And so leave it up to Yemenis to sort out their own destiny. Yemenis don't want Al-Qaeda and ISIS in their country. They're a small minority. People don't want them. They wreak havoc on civil society, and nobody wants them there. So Yemenis can be very and have been very proficient at getting rid of Al-Qaeda and ISIS on their own. Now they're having to deal with that front as well as, seeing America as the aggressor. I mean, there are posters all over Yemen that say USA kills Yemeni people. They see this as a U.S.-Saudi war on their country.
So that, does that help recruiting for Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
That's not going to help recruiting for anybody because the people who are against U.S. intervention in Yemen are the Houthis, who have no... And not just the Houthis, they're ordinary Yemenis. They're people like you and me. They're my family back home. Nobody wants to attack America for anything. People just don't want America or the UAE or the Saudis intervening in their own country's destiny.
So we're helping, if I understand correctly, we're helping Saudi Arabia bomb the people who are the most effective enemies of Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Yemen.
Yes.
In helping them bomb the Houthis, that's what we're doing.
Yes.
You know, you would think if that idea got some airtime.
You know who's been saying that, actually? Chris Murphy, Senator Chris Murphy, has been very vocal against, U.S. support because he says those very same things, that we're helping these groups and not, Mm-hmm. And Senator Rand Paul has also been saying this very vocally. And recently, Senator Bernie Sanders joined that fight and Mike Lee. And they tried to propose intervention. And if you hear what they say in the Senate, this is what they're saying. They're saying, we're working with these terrorist groups over there. We are enabling them. We are, we're seeing as the enemy over there. We're starving children to death. This isn't some famine happening somewhere far away. This is what we're doing to this country.
Right. Now, it reminds me a little of Syria where, an Iranian-backed Syrian government was doing a certain amount of effective fighting against ISIS, but America still considered them the enemy. I mean, the Iranian-backed Saudi government.
I think we have to be very careful about which groups we fund and for what reason. And when you have a group like in Yemen, the Hadi government has sent a delegation to the UN for negotiation, and among that delegation was a person who's listed on the U.S. list of terrorists. They're not being, they're not hiding this affiliation with Al-Qaeda. They're being very open. So why are we still continuing to support these people as our allies?
Mm-hmm. Okay, then this may actually be more like the final question. You alluded to having relatives near that port city that's currently under Houthi control, and yet you grew up in the South. So do you have family on both sides of the what is called the Civil War?
Yeah, so I have family in Aden, in Sana'a, which is the capital. It's also under Houthi control. In Hodeidah, which is under Houthi control. In Taiz, which is split between Houthis and the coalition forces and has seen tremendous devastation over the last few years. So I have family all over Yemen, and this is the reason I'm doing this. I'm not doing it because my work revolves around Yemen in any way. I'm doing it because this is the country I love, and people I love are being affected and being impacted every single day by this.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And I gather that as far as what people can do about this, if they share your view on it, kind of write your congressional representative, or you know, are there Facebook groups or anything like that?
Honestly, that's the best way to go about it. If they want to learn more, we have a Twitter page set up called @YemenSource. They can follow me on Twitter as well. My page is dedicated to this cause, @Shireen818. But if they can just call their senators and their congressmen, tell them that we don't want any intervention in Yemen. This is not a call for intervention. This is the very opposite. You know, please introduce legislation that would end U.S. war in Yemen, or support any kind of legislation that's already out there.
Okay. And we will, on the site, on the bloggingheads.tv site, because this will be seen both on YouTube and on Blogging Heads, but on the bloggingheads.tv site, we will have your Twitter handle right where your name is, if people want to click on that and follow you. Well, thanks so much, Shireen, and congratulations again on being a doctor.
Thank you.
And you start teaching in the fall at Michigan State?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, enjoy it. And thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.